I wrote a book, which copies are in the bookstore, a book entitled Missed Opportunities for Peace, U.S. Middle East Policy 1981-86, which looks at a number of times during those years, 81-86, when I think it's pretty clear, I think the evidence is pretty clear, that there were possibilities for movement toward negotiations, and that leadership in both the Arab side and the Israeli side, at least some of the leadership, not all of the leadership, were looking to the U.S. to play a helpful role. And I'm afraid we're disappointed in what role the U.S. played, at least during that period. So that's a book you might want to pick up if you're interested in the bookstore. I worked on that, and then in 1987, I organized something that's now called the U.S. Interreligious Committee for Peace in the Middle East, which is a committee of 1,500 American Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders, all Americans, working together in this country to encourage the kind of public atmosphere of support that would encourage what we think is necessary in the way of a creative, active, sustained role by our own government to help achieve peace in the Middle East. There are some materials about the committee which you're welcome to pick up. I haven't said this, and maybe I don't know what happens back there, but the tape can be started any time. The subject matter for this week is the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Is peace possible? Each session of the four sessions, we'll get into some piece of that topic. I think it'd be good if people got to a few of the sessions, but hopefully, even if you only get to one, if you're only planning to get to one, you'll get something out of it. That number one, and these are my goals, will help you feel that this issue is an issue which you can deal with. And I say that in part out of my experience with a lot of people who feel that it's a very, very difficult issue to deal with. That it's either overwhelming, it's too complicated, or if you've talked with Jews or Arabs about it, it's too emotional, that it's too controversial. And so I hope my number one goal is that you feel after a session or several sessions talking about the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict that it's an issue you might be interested in talking again about and feel some confidence that, yes, this is an issue that, you know, can be talked about and can be discussed. And second, I hope a second goal is that you come away from a session or several sessions feeling that it's a topic that needs to be talked about in a way that neither is a simple, narrow, partisan way, I'm for Israel and that's all I need to know, or I think the Arabs are right and that's all I need to know. That is, that it's not just, that it's more than a simple partisan way, and that it is not so dominated by partisan views and the complexity of it that if I don't have a direct stake in it, I won't touch it. Because I think that's another tendency that people have. I think a place to start, not the only place, but a place to start on this topic, Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is with the history of it. Though there are some who would say, if you're interested in talking about peace in the Middle East, you better not start with the history. And the reason they say that, and it's well motivated, is because if you start with the history, oftentimes you end with the history, because the history, of course, is not one history. It's the history as seen, as perceived, as felt, as suffered from people on one side of the conflict or the other. And of course, the way they see the history of the conflict, depending on where they stand, or the way you see, or I see, the history of the conflict, depends in part on where you stand. I have a rabbi friend who once was on a television show with a Catholic archbishop, and at the end of the show, the archbishop came up to him and said, "You know, Rabbi, I was very moved. I've never met you. I was very impressed with you. And you know, if things had been different, you would have made a very good Catholic bishop." Well, the rabbi said, "You know, if I had been born where you were born, raised in the family you had been raised, there's a good chance that I might have been a Catholic bishop." But then, of course, the rabbi turned it right around and said, "But," and this is Bishop Fulton Sheen, Bishop Sheen, "if you had been born in Baltimore in an Orthodox family, you might well today be a rabbi like me." truth in a certain sense is autobiographical. And so the way I'd like to begin talking about the history of the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict is briefly go around the room and let you say to me something about that conflict, about the Arabs, the Israelis, Palestinians, that conflict, the Middle East conflict, some event or date or something or name or something that comes into your mind that in some ways means something to you about this conflict. Now obviously if you were personally involved in the conflict there may be many of these things, but I'm sure all of us have some impression from the conflict that relates to something that happened in it. And I'd just like to hear what they are. And say your name when you... Anybody eager to start or can we just go around? Something, some event, something about the Arab-Israeli conflict. Go ahead. Say your name.
Diane. The big impression, probably because I was born that year, was the state of Israel coming into being and what was behind that.
Okay. See that? You see that? Already controversy. Who else? An event, something about this conflict that you remember that comes to your mind. This is impressions, not, you're not, there's no, nobody's going to come up with the right answer to this one.
Arab Israeli War.
A year?
67?
Okay, close enough. 1967, if I use A and I, that's Arab-Israeli. AIP is Palestinian included. All right, Arab-Israeli War. Another one.
Early history, probably from 48 through 67 up there, whereas the early years of Israel was fighting to protect themselves a lot.
Okay, so I'll put that in here. I'm not going to have space to do this exactly chronologically, but You're saying that Arab attacks on Israel,
Israel defends Israel to defend themselves and...
Okay. Okay. Who else?
Should have had somebody else do this blackboard. This is why I didn't become a school teacher.
Israel defending themselves. Israelis defending themselves. Okay, between 48 and 67. Who else? Yes. Intifada, okay. Can you put a year to it?
It's been going on maybe 3 years, 4 years?
Actually six, 1987, December 1987, the Palestinian Intifada. Okay, someone else. Intifada means uprising in Arabic or throwing it off, and what it refers to is Palestinians demonstrating, throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers, a whole sort of, literally, a kind of uprising of Palestinians, largely, by the way, led by teenagers, young people, rather than older people. In fact, many older people sort of more cautious and saying, don't do that, you're going to get killed and nothing's going to change. Yep.
I think one of the things about Israel's, the Jews returning to Israel is that's confusing and hard for me to deal with is the interpretation that this is fulfillment of biblical prophecy.
Aha. Okay. Let's see. Well, let's put it up here next to the foundation. Okay. And obviously there's both Jewish understandings of that, and there's different Jewish understandings of that, and Christian understandings of that. And there are, of course, different Christian understandings of it. But it has to do, in some ways, that whole connection for Christians in this country has been made more by evangelical Christians in the United States and some of the writings that they have produced. Anyone else? An event? Something personal, not personal, something to do with this conflict that... Yeah?
Okay. After the creation of Israel, the state of Israel, the creation of all the relocation camps, and long-term impacts of those, they're still with us.
Okay. Palestinian refugee camps. Okay? Who else?
Along those same lines, the story of the Exodus after the war.
Okay? I'll put that up here before 48, but right. The Exodus. And obviously a word that has historical echoes, doesn't it? I mean, it's not the first Exodus, and that's why the word has such power, is because it's the second time in Jewish history when that word comes into play. Okay? Yes?
I think one of the events for me, and I think it's probably true for a lot of people in our country that know some Jewish people but don't know any Palestinians, and probably sometime in the last 4 or 5 years, I've personally gotten to a point where I realized the Palestinians have a point of view. And I think that's shared by people in our country more than it was ever before. The Palestinians were always bad, and for a lot of different reasons, I think a lot of us have started to realize that Israel can be the oppressor, and Palestinians have a point of view.
Is there an event in the history?
Yeah. I can't think of one.
If this is true for anyone else, that sort of you've come to a sort of new sense that Palestinians have a point of view that we got to listen to them too, is there an event or time when...
Well, it would be, as he was saying before, when the lands were taken back in 48, they had to kick people that had been on the lands for hundreds of years.
But was that the time that we first thought that about the Palestinians? His what I'm hearing you say is his impression was that at that time we didn't really focus that much on...
Well, I've just seen it in writing the last few years.
How about the resettlement issue where they build these new towns in the captured areas and stuff and sort of push the areas out and form the Jewish farms.
All right, I'll put that. Jewish settlements. Back, yes.
Also, say the West Bank. So.
The West Banks, okay. West Bank settlements, okay. Jewish settlements, West Bank. This, yep.
Well, I haven't gone there, but for people that I know of that have gone there, they almost all came back saying, I really never understood the thing, and I don't know what it laid on, but that's in the last few years too.
Right. Well, it's interesting that I think, at least in Christian churches, the idea of a trip there that would include listening to the Palestinians even is a relatively new idea in the course of this history in terms of numbers of people participating in it. Anyone else have an event or thing that relates to the history of the conflict?
Invasion of Lebanon.
All right, invasion of Lebanon. Do you remember when that comes? What date? What year? 1982. I'm gonna write it out of order, but please, 1982. Don't tell anybody that I did that. 1982. Invasion of Lebanon. In fact, my sense in many churches is that the war in Lebanon and the images of the war in Lebanon on the television screens and in the magazines, the surrounding of Beirut, the massacre of the Palestinian refugees, by the way, not by Israeli soldiers, but under the view of Israeli soldiers by Christian Lebanese soldiers in those camps, Sabra and Shatila, that was, in a certain sense, a watershed for many American Christians in terms of, bang, all of a sudden the Palestinians were on the screen in a way that evoked sympathy rather than just fear and antipathy, which, of course, the Palestinian image of terrorist had earlier evoked from people. So I think, I'm glad that was mentioned. I think it is a invasion of Lebanon. I should put Israeli invasion because... Anyone else? Another guest? Yes.
There was a news, one of the news magazine type TV shows where there's a, I believe she's a Palestinian woman that's working for the peace. It's very articulate and does a very good job.
Who is it, Martin? Who's he talking about? Palestinian woman working for peace. Hanan, Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, who's a professor of literature and medieval literature and so forth at Beer Zeit University, who's the spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation. That's interesting too, in terms of the emphasis on women and in this conference and at Holden, that this Palestinian, by the way, Christian, Palestinian Christian woman, who at a certain point is chosen as the spokesperson for the Palestinian movement, becomes for many people, partly she communicates very well. I mean, she speaks in behalf of the Palestinian ways that really can be understood, but that choice becomes, in a way, sort of escalates the amount of positive attention that Palestinians are given in this country. So Hanan Ashrawi, an individual, I'm sure we could probably think of other individual names in this conflict that have done various things for the images about the conflict and so forth, like Arafat. We were talking about Arafat's name before, who doesn't go with Hanan Ashrawi in a certain sense in this terms of how the Palestinian message is communicated. Anyone else? An event? Yes?
How about the pre-state formation terrorism by the Israelis?
Okay.
45, 48?
Yes, let's see. Pre-state Jewish terrorism.
Freedom fighting terrorists.
Well, freedom fighting, right?
Whatever it was.
No, of course the terminology makes a great deal of difference, doesn't it? I mean, if you think of Palestinians who invade, come across the border into Israel as freedom fighters, it's very one image, and if you think of them as terrorists, it's another, and similarly if the Israelis or Jews. Yes?
I'm thinking almost in the same thing as the Palestinian Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir.
Yes.
His personality, I think, is one of the things that changed Americans' points of view sometimes.
In a direction more sympathetic with the Palestinians, you mean?
Right.
Right, right. Okay. Yes, I think you're right. Okay. And of course, just mentioning Yitzhak Shamir, who was the last Prime Minister of Israel, relates to the two main political strands in Israel itself, the Likud and Labor Party, and the fact that Shamir represented the Likud and was that party had been dominant since 77, where before that it was the Labor Party, which had a very different way of speaking about the conflict, even if it may have done some of the same things. It certainly had a different image in terms of American perception. Anybody else? What is it?
Yom Kippur War,
absolutely. The 1967 war, 1973, or Yom Kippur War. In fact, one of the ways to study this conflict is to look at it in terms of the wars. The 1948 war, the 1956 war, the invasion of Egypt over the Suez Canal issue. I don't know if you remember, Israel, France, and Britain. The 1967 war, the 1973 war, the 1982 war in Lebanon. And of course, one of the things that Israelis and Arabs are very conscious about is that if there is not a negotiated peace, there is at some point on the horizon a 1990-something war. At least that's the feeling. Not only the feeling, but also the so-called experts who think about these things, both on the Arab side and the Israeli side, would agree with the feeling. They would say if there's not a negotiated peace, there's another war. Anyone else? Yep.
Mine's more of a personal comment.
Good.
I was in Israel in 1979, and that was the time President Carter was there,
yes,
trying to talk peace.
Yes.
And we were traveling through Lebanon, and our bus had Hebrew on it.
Uh-huh.
And there were stones thrown at us.
Mm-hmm.
Just a personal feeling of that pain.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Frightening.
Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting time that the hate is expressed. 1979, you said, the time when Carter was there. In fact, 1979, it's interesting, no one mentioned this. I think this is partly because this conflict, I think, has a way of making us more pessimistic than most conflicts we look at. And so it's interesting that no one mentioned, in terms of events in the conflict, the fact that Egypt-Israeli peace treaty or President Sadat. It's almost like it doesn't fit, you know? It just doesn't fit, because they actually made a peace treaty. We have a feeling about this conflict, and by the way, this is one thing I think we as American Christians share with many Arabs and Jews. Even though we're not as close to it emotionally, we all share a sense of deep pessimism, I think, about this conflict. That this may be a conflict that is not resolvable. And so it's interesting, as you mentioned, 1979, where you have which was the year in March 1979 when the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel was signed. President Carter having played a key role in that process. And you mentioned traveling in Lebanon and getting stones thrown at the bus. And there's a connection between the fact that the peace treaty had just been made with Egypt and Israel and the fact that Lebanese or Palestinians in Lebanon were throwing stones at the bus because there was a great deal of hostility in the rest of the Arab world to that fact. Let's see, I'll put EI peace and Arab or other Arab hostility. All right, let's stop. Let me take out something that I suspect after I did it you're not going to be able to read. But that was my wife's very helpful comment as I almost finished it. She came in and said, she said, well, but will people be able to read it? And I said, I don't know. I think that while the people who say that if you want to talk about peace in the Middle East, you've got to put the history aside, you've got to put the history behind you, there's a certain good intention about that view, and also a certain correctness or a certain accuracy in the sense that you can't dwell on the history forever. You have to begin to talk about the future. I am one who believes, maybe it's because of the experience we had in the Middle East, where part of what we had to do for the 3 years was to hear the history told by the different people and somehow be able to absorb the different histories as experienced by the different peoples, and still then begin to think about how peace is possible in light of those histories. I am one who believes you can't have peace in the Middle East unless in some sense you're coping with the histories. And I'm also one who thinks that the histories that are relevant to this conflict don't start in 1948.
You're right, I can't read it.
That was my wife that was right, not me. But I'll tell her.
Another conflict,
right? Well, you can come up here after and see if what I've said is really what's on here. But this will be helpful to me. I said I didn't think it's a conflict that you can talk about its history only beginning in 1948. In fact, sometimes I did before the class started, I tease people a little bit and say that I think this conflict started in 48, meaning a short time after the crucifixion of Jesus, because it was in that period in the first century when Christian churches were forming and when they're developed, not, I believe, according to the intention of Jesus, when they're developed real tensions between the Jewish community who didn't accept Jesus and those Jews who did accept Jesus as the Messiah. And if you've read, and I'm sure you've all read, in the Gospels and in the letters of Paul and in some of the other New Testament writings, you find statements which you have to say are anti-Jewish. Not statements by Jesus, but statements by writers in the formative years of the church, which came out of real tensions between Jews and Christians in the beginnings of the Christian churches. And those statements, those feelings of the Jews killed Jesus, the Jews, in a certain sense, by rejecting Jesus, have lost God's favor, lost God's love. By rejecting Jesus. That sentiment, which of course gets elaborated on in Christian writings. I mean, some of you are familiar with them, and if you're not, you could get familiar. There are plenty of them, Christian writings, in the succeeding centuries provided part of the basis, an important part of the basis, for anti-Semitism. And that's mixed into this history. Now that's 48, but the first date I put up here is 3500 BCE, 3500 years before the birth of Christ. And the reason I put it on is to make note of the fact that it's at that time, by that time, when you have significant settlement and even urban settings in the area of Syria, Palestine. Not nation states in the sense of Syria today or Palestine, but you have major urban centers developed and life developed and communal life developed in these areas. And when Egypt, Lower and Upper Egypt are united. So in some sense, the Arab players in this game, or the players in the game, are already there. They're already there. And they have history. They have that the current players today, particularly on the Arab side, are very conscious that they go back to them. And their sense of belonging to the place goes back to them. And then 1900 years before the birth of Christ, Abraham's journey from Ur in Iraq, by the way, that's where Ur is, would be today, to Canaan. And the fact that Abraham reaches Canaan and supposedly his tomb, Abraham's tomb, is in the West Bank. In a large, just on the outskirts of a large Palestinian city of Hebron. Or as Jews, Hebron. There's the tomb of the patriarch Abraham. 1900 BCE. 1022 before the birth of Christ, Saul, the first king of the Israelites. And so when we say the creation of Israel, which one? 1948 or 1022 BCE? We mean, most of us Christians, I think, most of us when we say creation of Israel, Jews or Christians or Muslims, we're thinking of 1948. But it's important to remember that that's the second creation of Israel. And the Jews, of course, in a much more lively way than Arabs or Christian, Western Christians, think of it that way. 587, the Babylonian exile, the destruction of Israel and Judah, the two kingdoms, having occurred between 700 and 587, and then Jews taken off to exile in Babylonia and taken away from what was the center of Jewish life religiously, the temple, taken, ripped away from the temple, the center of their life religiously, and taken to Babylonia. And then 538, allowed to return by a more flexible Persian leader. 167, Jews revolt. They establish another independent, semi-autonomous area, Judea. Birth of Jesus, of course, in 4 BCE. Crucified 33 years later, Christian churches begin. Then in 70, another Jewish revolt, and these revolts trying to reestablish Israel and reestablish Jewish control of the temple and of life in Jerusalem and the surrounding areas. And this revolt put down by the Romans and the temple destroyed. 70 AD or 70 BC, 70 CE, the Common Era. Now, this date of 70, when the temple is destroyed and the 587, the Babylonian exile, really are the dates that are significant in terms of the Jewish diaspora. So that when Jews think, when reference to Jewish diaspora, it's not just a question of, you know, Jews who aren't in Israel now, but a whole history of having been torn away from the center of Jewish life, which had a place. It wasn't just an idea, it had a place. On a certain area of land that Jews felt very deeply, they had been given by God. Whatever, you know, who is now going to say, you know, what God did about that? But that Jews believed very deeply was the place for them as God had commanded. 313 AD or CE. Constantine, the Roman Empire still in existence, making Christianity the official religion of the empire. I think a very significant date in Christian history, in terms of Christian church having moved from a persecuted minority to, in a certain sense, an establishment church. Very different roles for the church, and very different roles in terms of how Jews experience Christian power. It's one thing when we're being eaten by lions. Jews might well identify with that. But it's another thing when the flag and the cross are joined, as in a certain sense they are with Constantine, and of course are a number of times later in history. 570, a whole nother dimension develops in terms of the background of this conflict, and it's the birth of Muhammad, who becomes, as he grows up and finds himself having a revelation from God, becomes the prophet for a community, initially a tribe, and then a broader community, of the head of a state, or head almost of an empire, that spreads in 2-3 decades' time throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and Asia, and becomes, and is today, and we're conscious of it today again, a sort of rival center of religious, both religious inspiration and also political power. Political power. And I think we're, again, as Western Christians, more conscious of this today, probably at any time, than we have been since maybe the Crusade period, or the wars between Muslims and Christians back several centuries ago. 1099, first Crusades from Europe, Christian Crusades to take Jerusalem from the Muslims, succeed. 1099. 100 years later, 1187, Saladin, Arab Muslim leader, retakes Jerusalem for the Muslims. And if you've been in Jerusalem, you know that one of the main streets in East Jerusalem is Saladin Street. And that's not just history. That's also people's feeling of a sense of pride and a sense of confidence that this will happen again, that we will take back Jerusalem again. Muslims. A feeling among Muslims, a feeling among Arabs, that this is ours. A feeling also based on what they did with the city during the time they had with it, as compared, interestingly and rather sadly, with what Christians did when we took it. We, I don't want to hold us all, you know, we may get blamed for a lot, but I mean, that leadership out of our tradition did, for example, when the Crusaders took it, what they did immediately was close the mosque, closed Jewish worship. They closed it out. When the Muslims took the city, they allowed Christian worship and Jewish worship in the city. This was not an issue for them. All the issue was that they were in control, but not that the others had no place. Where, sadly, when the Crusaders took it, it was basically a question: you were either Christian or you were out in terms of any significant role in the society. The 1517, the Ottoman Empire established as an Islamic empire with its center in Constantinople in what is present-day Turkey. But it's an empire, an Islamic empire, which controlled the whole Middle East for 400 years, 1517 to 1917. So for a whole lot of relatively modern history, there has been an Islamic empire loosely held together through a kind of provincial governor system and a system of where you, if you weren't Muslim, you're a second-class citizen and you sort of pay a tax for that. You're not persecuted particularly, but you also clearly know the limits of what you can do in a society that is Muslim. But for 400 years, that's the way it was in the Middle East. 1517 to 1917, World War I, when the Turks made the wrong decision to go with the Germans. And lost the war is when that empire then came apart. I've jumped from 1517 to 1880s, and there are various jumps in this, and other people now, this may stimulate you to say, well, wait, you left out, isn't that important? And that's great. But the end of the last century was the first major wave of Jewish immigration to Palestine. And it was sparked by the pogroms in Russia. That is a period in Tsarist Russia in the latter part of the 19th century, where Jews as a minority were picked, singled out, and were killed in large numbers. Numbers vary, estimates vary, but 100,000 is a reasonable estimate, probably more, but that's a mess that you can be pretty confident about. And large numbers of Jews left and went to Palestine. In 1897 was the first Congress of Jews to form what was called the World Zionist Organization. Zionist simply being the word that is the title for Jewish nationalism. So the World Zionist Congress was established in 1897. Even as early as 1904, there's a very famous I'm blank on his name now, but Nachla Azuri, I think it is, who wrote a book that got widely disseminated, at least among intellectual circles in the Arab world, talking about the danger to the Arabs of Jewish nationalism, 1904. 1917, of course, 1914, 1917, World War I, and you had in 1917 a convergence of things that sort of, again, say what's at the heart of this conflict with the Balfour Declaration, a British foreign ministry declaration, which essentially said that on one hand we support the idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, but it must be a homeland, it must be accomplished without compromising or negatively affecting the civil or human rights of the population which are there, that is the non-Jewish population. Nice theory, nicely stated, but in a way impossible or near impossible to fulfill. And that happened in 1917. And of course you have the fact that the British did that, passed that resolution, adopted that policy, puts them in Arab eyes, in a certain sense, rightly so, behind the idea of the creation of Israel or the creation of a Jewish homeland. 1922, you had at the end of the war, Arab nationalism, which was as in other parts of the world, where nationalist groups were struggling against colonial control by European powers, you had Arab nationalists who wanted to have independence in their countries, in their areas. And you had the British and the French during World War I offering certain promises to Arabs and other parties that if they assisted in the war against Germany and the Turks, we would assist you, we would support your independence aspirations at the end of the war. Well, the end of the war came, but the promises were not kept. And in fact, you had at the end of World War I, in this area that we're talking about in the Middle East, you had a formation of what were called the British and the French mandates. So a continuation of British and French control over the areas. And then you had behind that going on Arab nationalism struggling for independence and Jewish nationalism struggling to create a homeland for Jews in Palestine. During 1922 to 1945, several Arab countries gained their independence. Jordan, ones that are in the news today and are part of the peace process right now, they gained their independence. Jordan, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon. Jordan and Egypt predominantly from the British, Syria and Lebanon mainly from the French. They gained their independence during the years 22 to 45. During the period, this whole period, 1920 to 45, long before the creation of Israel, and long before, say, just the immediate pre-state period, where say, 45 to 48, you had growing tensions. This is over a period of really 25, 30, 40 years, depending on what events you count it from, growing tensions in Palestine, in this small piece of the Middle East, where Jews saw as the place for recreating Israel, and Palestinian Arabs were increasingly seeing as an Arab state, part of an Arab state, or a separate Arab state. You had growing tensions, fighting, sporadic demonstrations, assassinations. This going on for a period of 25, 30 years, even before World War II. Something that I don't think was mentioned in our earlier go-round, but can't be left out, I think, 1938 to 45, Nazism and the Holocaust. For many Jews, for whom the idea of going back to Israel had always been in their minds, as an idea, as a prayer, as a part of seasonal and religious holidays celebrations where the idea of returning to Jerusalem would be celebrated, for many Jews for whom that idea had as much of a kind of religious and a symbolic significance, Nazism and the Holocaust forced it to have a real significance. That is to say, if you could speak about it as something that might happen sometime before the Holocaust, many Jews after the Holocaust or during the Holocaust came to the conclusion that it was something that had to happen here and now, that Jews needed their own place. And an interesting expression of that in our own country is that in 1942, there was a very famous conference of Jewish leaders, American Jewish leaders, at the Biltmore Hotel in New York called the Biltmore Conference, and out of it came the Biltmore Declaration, which was the first time that American Jewish leadership had united in support of the idea of creation of a Jewish state. Up until then, many American Jewish leaders were very critical of the idea of creating a Jewish state because they were, particularly in this country, committed to the idea of Jews being a people but also being a part of nations and not a separate, necessarily a separate nation. But with Nazism and the Holocaust, many Jews and many Jewish leaders came to the conclusion we have to have a state. And that period, 38 to 45, is crucial. 1947, the British, who were dealing with this situation in Palestine, where on the one hand they had Arab nationalists struggling to get them out and attacking them, and on the other hand they had Jewish nationalists, Zionist organizations, present on the ground fighting against them, trying to get them out. And they also had Zionist Jewish organizations and Arab organizations fighting each other and being the mandate power trying to preserve some kind of peace and order. They threw up their hands. Literally threw up their hands. And guess where they threw the problem? Exactly. That's when powers think about the United Nations, you know? When things are going well for us, whether we're Britain or the United States or wherever, we hardly think of the UN. But when we are really in trouble and the swamp is closing in, then, the United Nations. And so Britain threw this problem into the lap of the United Nations, and with U.S.-Soviet, interesting, U.S.-Soviet cooperation, a resolution was adopted in the United Nations partitioning Palestine, dividing it. If there are two national groups, they can't come to any accommodation. They're fighting more and more. They both have claims. The UN came to the conclusion we have to divide Palestine. For the Jewish national movement, that was a tremendous accomplishment because it meant from having no international recognition except Britain in the Balfour Declaration, now the UN was saying there should be a Jewish homeland. The UN was saying, which means the world community of nations by majority, but still doing it. For the Arabs, it was totally unacceptable. Because for the Arabs, what was happening was that as they, again, after World War II, like after World War I, were wanting to establish their own nation, they felt what was happening were Jews coming from Europe, supported by Western powers, in a certain sense, continuing colonialism. And so the Arabs rejected the partition, the Jews welcomed it. 1948, Israel is created. There's a war between the surrounding Arab states and Israel. And in 1949, finally, some rough armistice agreements are worked out. But armistice agreements mean essentially cold agreements. That is, it's not peace, but it's essentially stopping the fighting. And from 1948, the establishment of Israel in that first war, you then have a series of wars. I said this before. You can almost organize the conflict from 48 to the present around several wars. You had a series of wars in 56, in 67, in 73, in 82, that were wars which, in terms of their, you can look at the specific causes and military movements and certain closing of waterways, certain statements intending to destroy Israel, certain Israeli ideas about expanding a little bit. But basically the war was about the same thing. From the Arab side, they were wars to get rid of Israel. Because from the Arab side, the creation of Israel was a grave injustice to the Arab people as a whole, and particularly to the Arabs of Palestine, who, when Israel was created, had their dispersal, their diaspora. In fact, in Palestinian terms, the creation of Israel and that war, the defeat in the 48 war, the defeat of the Arabs, is called, and I may say this wrong, but a word in Arabic, it's called Nakba, which means the disaster. In that sense, when Palestinians talk about their Holocaust, though Jews, and I think by and large, I would say this too, in comparison, saying this Holocaust, that Holocaust, is wrong, because what it does is sort of talk about immense human suffering in sort of terms of balancing, you know? I think there's no usefulness in that. In fact, it's not very helpful, because then people argue about whose suffering is more, and I don't know what that gets us. But for Palestinians, this was their disaster. They understand something about the Holocaust, and most Palestinians talk with sympathy about the Jewish experience, the Holocaust. But for them, this was their disaster, when they were forced to leave their lands, sell their lands, leave their lands and flee, hoping maybe they would return because the Arabs were going to win the war, but they didn't, and so they wind up refugees outside of Palestine. Many hundreds of thousands of them. A smaller number remain in Palestine and are there today as part of Israel. Not happy, but there. Not wanting to leave. But you then had a series of wars from then to the present, or at least till 1982, where from the Arab side, the basic goal was get rid of Israel. From the Israeli side, the intention in the war was to fight the war so well that at the end of the war, the Arabs would then agree to peace. In other words, that Israel would prove that it's here to stay and they're not going to be defeated, and therefore there'd be peace. The results of the wars, however, of the individual wars certainly, was neither of those things. The Arabs didn't get rid of Israel, and Israel did not persuade the Arabs in any one of those wars taken by itself that the Arabs should make peace. Moving on, you had 1977, President Sadat, and there's, I said, no war by itself convinced anyone that you had to make peace, but I think it's clear that 1977, when President Sadat of Egypt decided to make this visit to Jerusalem and begin a process of negotiating a peace with Israel, the basic motivation of President Sadat was that he had come to the conclusion that there was no way the Arabs were going to defeat Israel militarily, and therefore a negotiated peace was the only alternative. Not a happy alternative, not an alternative of choice, but a certain sense an alternative of necessity. And he did this, he began this process. It was a tremendous break in the psychology of the region to have an Arab leader stand up and said, I'm ready to make peace with Israel. The only prominent Arab state leader who had done that publicly earlier than that, interestingly, was President Bourguiba of Tunisia, who in 1965 had said, we need to make peace with Israel and have a Palestinian state, basically saying things that are very current right now. He said it in 65. It was not welcomed by the Arab leaders. And the Israeli leaders were rather distrustful of it. That's one of the things about this conflict. Even when leaders say things that seem to have possibilities in them, there's so much bitterness, so much bad history,
that it's hard for the people on the other side, or even the leaders, to take it at face value, or even close to face value. So President Sadat makes this breakthrough. The U.S. becomes involved in a process, and there is, 2 years later, 1979, an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, and it's interesting to just make note of the fact that it took 2 years from the time Sadat said, I'm ready to make peace, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, before there was peace, before there was a peace treaty. And it took major efforts by President Carter to help make that happen. So that even when President Sadat made this grand gesture, the negotiations that had to go on between Israel and Egypt were very tough. And in fact, they broke down a couple of times. Once, where both parties said, we're not going to talk to the other. And that's what led to Camp David. That's what, in other words, it wasn't a thing that just kept going like this. It was something, it started, everybody's hopeful, and then it went crash. And it was that crash that led President Carter to decide he had to invite both leaders, Begin and Sadat, to come to Camp David. He did, and that started the process again. And I say that partly in light of the current situation, which is not an easy, obviously, peace process going on right now. Not easy. It's not just steady uphill. It's got various different motions to it. And how the U.S. involved in that is going to be important. 1980, I just put in a couple of other things to keep trying to help us see that other things are still going on. A huge war between Iran and Iraq. Well, first you had 1979, the same year as there's peace between Egypt and Israel, there's revolution in Iran. The Shah, a great friend of the United States, I mean, this was the atmosphere, U.S.-Iranian relations very positive. Not everybody happy with that, but that was what was going on. And there was a revolution inspired by religious messages and religious leadership. A tremendous revolution in Iran, and one that still is having its effect on regional realities and world realities today in a major way. 1980, and Soviet troops invading Afghanistan. Another thing which happened, wasn't related to Arab-Israeli, but was right there in the region and has to do with current movements, Islamic movements, tied in with that whole war in Afghanistan involving the Soviet Union. 1980, the Iran-Iraq War, which, you know, over 10 years killed, I think the number is 1.5 million people. A war which both the Soviet Union and the United States, most analysts would say, took the attitude, neither this nor that. I mean, sort of balancing and thinking that if both of those powers were to destroy each other, it wouldn't necessarily be bad for us. Both the Soviet Union and the United States taking that attitude about that war. 1.5 million people dead in the meantime, 10 years. 1982, the Israeli invasion, war in Lebanon, an initiative by the U.S., a Reagan initiative for peace, which doesn't go anywhere, partly our problem, partly the problem of the parties in the region not being ready. 1987, the Palestinian uprising, and this is significant because it's 20 years after the Six-Day War, in 1967 war. What the result of the war was that Israel took more territory. The Arabs lost, Israelis won, and included in the territories they took are the West Bank and Gaza, filled with Palestinian Arabs. And it's 20 years later, after Israel has occupied those territories, that the Palestinians rise up in a way that says to the average Israeli, we don't have things under control. Whatever else it says. I'm not saying whether Israelis respond positively or negatively to that. I'm saying that they do understand with the Palestinian uprising in 1987 that even after 20 years, things are not under control. And somehow we have to deal with the Palestinians. We're still dealing with the Palestinians. 1988, the Palestinian National Council, for the first time, this is the Palestinian National Council, is the sort of parliament in exile of the Palestinian National Movement. For the first time in 1988, 40 years after 1948, 40 years later, the Palestine National Council adopts a position which accepts Israel and says, in effect, that the Palestinians are prepared to accept a small state in part of Palestine alongside Israel. Essentially, and it's very interesting, the Palestinian Congress, when they did this, or Council, when they did it, they made reference to the UN partition plan and said, we accept that plan in principle, not the exact boundaries, because the boundaries wouldn't be the same today as they would have been back then, but we accept that principle. And it's interesting, in the Israeli Declaration of Independence in 48, Israel bases its international legal legitimacy on that partition resolution. So for the first time in 1988, you have these two peoples, Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, in this same piece of land, saying that we both accept the idea, the principle of partition. But it took 40 years from 1948. And one of the things that makes this conflict so bitter and so intense is, and the simplest way to say it is, if you go to Israel today, you get a map from the Ministry of Tourism of Israel, you will not see a line on the map. This is the end of the Mediterranean. This is Lebanon up here. Well, it's here. That's Lebanon. This is Jordan here. This is Egypt over here. And here is this piece of map. Jerusalem being about there. Well, it's not that close to the river. There. This is State of Jordan River here. And we talk about Gaza, it's a little piece there. We talk about the West Bank, and it's a piece that comes down like this. Includes a piece of Jerusalem. When you go to the Ministry of Tourism and get a map of Israel, there is no line here. There is no line. So you look at the map and it looks to you as if Israel goes from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River. And it has approximately this shape. If you go into a Palestinian home, I would be willing to guess, you will see the exact same shape. But it won't be called Israel. It'll be called Palestine. And you'll see it in a map on the wall. Many Palestinians have maps of Palestine in Arabic with the name Palestine on it. Many Palestinian women wear gold pendants with the shape of Palestine on in the piece of gold that hangs from a necklace. So one of the reasons that this conflict is so bitter and so in a way so intractable is because each of these peoples has claim to this very same shape and piece of land, including Jerusalem. My wife and I once talked to the rabbi in Jerusalem who had immigrated to Israel some 20 years ago, and he said to us, he said, you meet with the Palestinians, don't you? We said, yes. And he said, you know, what you've got to convince them is that we don't come here. We didn't come here as colonializers. When we come here, we are coming home. And I said to him, David, all that the Palestinians want you to understand is that they were home. And there, you know, to give it an Irish lilt, I there is the rub. there's the rub. That these two peoples, have these bone-level claims. I mean, we're not talking, people, we're not talking about ideas here. We're talking about what's in the bones. They have bone-level, centuries-old claims to the very same piece of land. And they have suffering either over centuries, in the case of the Jewish people, and in particular in this century, last century, and in the case of the Palestinians since 48, they have sufferings which give an intensity to their claim, which is in some ways impossible for any of us who are not Jewish or not Palestinian to imagine. And there they are. What is hopeful is that after all these years of conflict, there is now on both sides, at least in a portion of the society, don't assume agreement on this, either in Israel or among the Palestinians, but there is now in a portion of the Palestinian society and in Israeli Jewish society, there is an agreement on the idea that the principle of partition, the principle that we must each have a place in this space, is the basis for a future that we can live in together. And that's hope. That is hope. Some would say that it's just that belief is maybe held by 51% on each side. So it's no by no means inevitable. Yes.
One of the things that's kept Israel in control of the property there is the U.S. military support. When did that really start in terms of after 1948? And why did it start? Was it because you wanted a military presence in the Arab world, or was it Jewish pressure in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I'm going to have to say, because of the time, that I hope some people come back and we have some more time to talk about this. For the first 20 years of Israel's existence, Israel depended more on France for military support, mostly on France. And initially, in the foundation of Israel, interestingly enough, very significant support came via Czechoslovakia during that first war, I mean 48, and the lead up to that war. U.S. military support and strong military role with Israel started more in the mid-60s, and had as much to do, and this is the short answer, as much to do, in my view, with the Cold War as it did with Jewish pressure. Sure, there was Jewish support for U.S. supporting Israel, but I think it had as much to do with the Cold War as it did with, and with a view that the U.S. had that as the Cold War developed, the U.S. would develop its support for Israel while the Soviet Union was developing its support for various Arab states, including at that time Egypt. You remember that Egypt in the late 60s was more a Soviet client than it was a U.S. client, and it was Sadat who helped to turn that around in the early 70s. But that's a very important question. We have to break, given the time. I offer again...
I have a question.
Yes. Let's keep that until after, because I'm conscious that somebody else has to come in here to do another class. So I think, to be fair, we need to break, and we'll, you know, hopefully some of you will come back tomorrow. I'm here for 2 weeks, and welcome any conversations around meals and so forth. Thank you.